After a short distance, he felt a familiar nuzzling at his elbow, and he rather absently scratched the colt's ears. The small animal quivered with delight and rubbed against him affectionately. Then, unable to restrain himself any more, the colt galloped off into the meadow to pester a family of docilely feeding rabbits. Geryon found himself smiling. The morning was just too beautiful to allow the squabble with the princess to spoil it. There was, it seemed, something rather special about the Vale. The world around grew cold with the approach of winter, and was buffeted by storms and dangers. But here, it seemed as if the hand of Aludur stretched protectively above them, filling this special place with warmth and peace, and a kind of eternal and magical serenity. Geryon, at this trying point in his life, needed all of the warmth and peace that he could get. There were things that had to be worked out, and he needed a time, however brief, without storms and dangers to deal with them. He was halfway to Belgarath's tower before he realized that it had been there that he had been going all along. The tall grass was wet with dew, and his boots were soon soaked, but even that did not spoil the day. He walked around the tower several times, gazing up at it. Although he found the stone that marked the door quite easily, he decided not to open it. It would not be proper to go uninvited into the old man's tower, and, beyond that, he was not entirely certain that the door would respond to any voice but Belgarath's. He stopped quite suddenly, at that last thought, and started searching back, trying to find the exact instant when he had ceased to think of his grandfather as Mr. Wolf, and had finally accepted the fact that he was Belgarath. The changeover seemed significant, a kind of turning point. Still lost in thought, he turned then and walked across the meadow toward the large white rock the old man had pointed out to him from the tower window. Absently, he put one hand on it and pushed. The rock did not budge. Geryon set both hands on it and pushed again. Nothing happened. He stepped back and considered it. It wasn't really a vast boulder. It was rounded and white, and not quite as high as his waist. Heavy, certainly, but it should not be so inflexibly solid. He bent over to look at the bottom, and then he understood. The underside of this rock was flat. It would never roll. The only way to move it would be to lift one side and tip it over. He walked around the rock, looking at it from every angle. He judged that it was marginally movable. If he exerted every ounce of his strength, he might be able to lift it. He sat down and looked at it, thinking hard. As he did sometimes, he talked to himself, trying to lay out the problem. "Well, the first thing to do is to try to move it," he concluded. "Doesn't really look totally impossible. Then, if that doesn't work, we'll try it the other way." He stood up, stepped purposefully to the rock, wormed his fingers under the edge of it, and heaved. Nothing happened. "Have to try a little harder," he told himself. He spread his feet and set himself. He began to lift again, straining, the cords standing out in his neck. For the space of about 10 heartbeats, he tried as hard as he could to lift that stubborn rock, not to roll it over. He had given up on that after the first instant, but simply to make it budge, to acknowledge his existence. Though the ground was not particularly soft there, his feet actually sank as he strained against the rock's weight. Little dots seemed to swirl in front of his eyes as he released the rock and collapsed, gasping against it. He lay against the cold, gritty surface for several minutes, recovering.
"All right. Now we know that that won't work."
He stepped back and sat down. Each time he had done something with his mind before, it had been on impulse, a response to some crisis. He had never sat down and deliberately worked himself up to it. He discovered almost at once that the entire set of circumstances was completely different. The whole world seemed suddenly filled with distractions, Birds sang. A breeze brushed his face. An ant crawled across his hand. Each time he began to bring his will to bear, something pulled his attention away. There was a certain feeling to it. He knew that. A tightness in the back of his head and a sort of pushing out with his forehead. He closed his eyes, and that seemed to help. It was coming. It was slow, but he felt the will beginning to build in him. Remembering something, he reached inside his tunic and put the mark on his palm against the amulet. The force within him, amplified by that touch, built to a great roaring crescendo. He kept his eyes closed and stood up. Then he opened his eyes and looked hard at the stubborn white rock. "You will move," he muttered. He kept his right hand on the amulet and held out his left hand, palm up. "Now," he said sharply, and slowly began to raise his left hand in a lifting motion. The force within him surged, and the roaring sound inside his head became deafening. Slowly, the edge of the rock came up out of the grass. Worms and burrowing grubs who had lived out their lives in the safe, comfortable darkness under the rock flinched as the morning sunlight hit them. Ponderously, the rock raised, obeying Geryon's inexorable lifting hand. It teetered for a second on its edge, then toppled slowly over. The exhaustion he had felt after trying to lift the rock with his back was nothing compared to the bone-deep weariness that swept over him after he let the clenching of his will relax. He folded his arms on the grass and let his head sink down on them. After a moment or two, that peculiar fact began to dawn on him. He was still standing, but his arms were folded comfortably in front of him on the grass. He jerked his head up and looked around in confusion. He had moved the rock, certainly. That much was obvious, since the rock now lay on its rounded top with its damp underside turned up. Something else had also happened, however. Though he had not touched the rock, its weight had nonetheless been upon him as he had lifted it, and the force he had directed at it had not all gone at the rock. With dismay, Geryon realized that he had sunk up to his armpits in the firm soil of the meadow. "Oh, well, then now what do I do?" he asked himself helplessly. He shuddered away from the idea of once again mustering his will to pull himself out of the ground. He was too exhausted even to consider it. He tried to wriggle, thinking that he might be able to loosen the earth around him and work his way up an inch at a time, but he could not so much as budge. "Look what you've done," he accused the rock. The rock ignored him. A thought occurred to him. "Are you in there?" he asked, that awareness that seemed always to have been with him. The silence in his mind was profound.
"Help!"
he shouted. A bird, attracted by the exposed worms and bugs that had been under the rock, cocked one eye at him, and then went back to its breakfast. Geryon heard a light step behind him, and craned around, trying to see. The colt was staring at him in amazement. Hesitantly, the small horse thrust out his nose and nuzzled Geryon's face.
"That's a good horse," Geryon said, relieved not to be alone, at least.
An idea came to him.
"You're going to have to go get Hetar," he told the colt.
The colt pranced about and nuzzled his face again.
"Oh, stop that," Geryon commanded. "This is serious."
Cautiously, he tried to push his mind into the colt's thoughts. He tried a dozen different ways until he finally struck the right combination by sheer accident. The colt's mind flitted from here to there without purpose or pattern. It was a baby's mind, vacant of thought, receiving only sense impressions. Geryon caught flickering images of green grass and running and clouds in the sky and warm milk. He also felt the sense of wonder in that little mind, and the abiding love that the colt had for him. Slowly, painfully, Geryon began constructing a picture of Hetar in the colt's wandering thoughts. It seemed to take forever.
Hetar,
Geryon said over and over.
Go get Hetar. Tell him that I'm in trouble.
The colt scampered around and came back to stick his soft nose in Geryon's ear.
Please pay attention,
Geryon cried. Please. Finally, after what seemed hours, the colt seemed to understand. He went several paces away, then came back to nuzzle Geryon again.
Go get Hetar,
Geryon ordered, stressing each word. The colt pawed at the ground, then turned and galloped away, going in the wrong direction. Geryon started to swear. For almost a year now, he had been exposed to some of the more colorful parts of Barak's vocabulary. After he had repeated all of the phrases that he remembered 6 or 8 times, he began to extemporize. A flickering thought came back to him from the now-vanished colt. The little beast was chasing butterflies. Geryon pounded the ground with his fists, wanting to howl with frustration. The sun rose higher, and it started to get hot. It was early afternoon when Hetar and Silk, following the prancing little colt, found him.
How in the world did you manage to do that?
Silk asked curiously.
I don't want to talk about it,
Geryon muttered, somewhere between relief and total embarrassment.
He probably can do many things that we cannot,
Hetar observed, climbing down from his horse and untying Durnik's shovel from his saddle.
The thing that I do not understand, though, is why he would want to do that.
Oh, I'm positive he had a good reason for it, Silk assured him. Do you think we should ask him? It's probably very complicated. I'm sure simple men like you and me would not be able to understand it.
Do you suppose that he is finished with whatever it is he is doing?
Oh, we could ask him, I suppose.
I would not want to disturb him. It could be very important.
Oh, it almost has to be.
Will you please get me out of here?
Geryon begged. Are you sure that you're quite finished? We can wait, if you're not done yet.
Please?
Geryon asked, almost in tears. Chapter 12.
Why did you try to lift it?
Belgarath asked Geryon the next morning, after he and Aunt Paul had returned and Silk and Hetar had solemnly informed them of the predicament in which they had found the young man the afternoon before.
It seemed like the best way to tip it over,
Geryon answered.
You know, kind of get hold of it from underneath and then roll it, sort of.
Why didn't you just push against it, close to the top? It would have rolled over if you had done it that way.
I didn't think of that. Don't you realize that soft earth won't accept that kind of pressure? Well, I do now, but wouldn't pushing on it have just moved me backward?
You have to brace yourself, Belgarath explained. That's part of the whole trick. As much of your will goes to holding yourself immobile as it does to pushing against the object that you are trying to move. Otherwise, all you do is just shove yourself away.
But I didn't know that. It's the first time I've ever tried to do anything unless it was an emergency. Will you stop that?
He demanded crossly of Sinedra, who had collapsed into gales of laughter as soon as Silk had finished telling them about Geryon's blunder. She laughed even harder now.
I think that you are going to have to explain a few things to him, Father. He doesn't seem to have even the most rudimentary idea about the way forces react against each other.
She looked at Geryon critically.
It's lucky you didn't decide to throw it. You might have flung yourself halfway back to Meregor. I really don't think it's all that funny,
Geryon told his friends, who were all grinning openly at him.
Well, it's not as easy as it looks, you know.
He realized that he had just made a fool of himself, and he was not sure if he were more embarrassed or hurt by their amusement.
Come with me, boy,
Belgarath said firmly.
It looks as if we're going to have to start at the very beginning.
Well, it's not my fault. I didn't know. You should have told me.
I did not know that you were planning to start experimenting so soon, the old man replied. Most of us have sense enough to wait for guidance before we start rearranging the local geography.
Well, at least I did manage to move it, Geryon said defensively, as he followed the old man across the meadow toward the tower.
Splendid. Did you put it back the way you found it?
Why? What difference does it make?
We don't move things here in the Vale. Everything that's here is here for a reason, and they are all supposed to be exactly where they are.
I didn't know,
Geryon apologized.
You do now. Let's go put it back where it belongs.
They trudged along in silence.
Grandfather,
Geryon said finally.
Yes?
When I moved the rock, it seemed that I was getting the strength to do it from all around me. It seemed just to flow in from every place. Does that mean anything?
That's the way it works, Belgarath explained. When we do something, we take the power to do it from our surroundings. When you burned Kamdar, for example, you drew the heat from all around you, from the air, the ground, from everyone who was in the area. You drew a little heat from everything to build the fire. When you tipped the rock over, you took the force to do it from everything nearby.
I thought it all came from inside.
Only when you create things, the old man replied. That force has to come from within us. For anything else, we borrow. We gather up a little power from here and there and put it all together, and then turn it loose, all at one spot. Nobody's big enough to carry around the kind of force it would take to do even the simplest sort of thing.
Then that's what happens when somebody tries to unmake something?
Geryon said intuitively.
He pulls in all of the force, but then he can't let it go, and it just...
He spread his hands and jerked them suddenly apart.
Belgarath looked narrowly at him. You have got a strange sort of mind, boy. You understand the difficult things quite easily. But you can't seem to get hold of the simple ones. There's the rock.
He shook his head.
Oh, that will never do. Put it back where it belongs, and try not to make so much noise this time. That racket you raised yesterday echoed all over the Vale.
What do I do?
Gather in the force. Take it from everything around.
Geryon tried.
Not from me! The old man exclaimed sharply.
Geryon excluded his grandfather from his field of reaching out and pulling in. After a moment or two, he felt as if he were tingling all over, and that his hair was standing on end.
Now what?
He asked, clenching his teeth to hold it in.
Push out behind you, and push at the rock at the same time.
What do I push at behind me?
Everything. And at the rock as well. It has to be simultaneous.
Won't I get sort of squeezed in between?
Tense yourself up.
We'd better hurry, Grandfather, Geryon said. I feel like I'm going to fly apart.
Hold it in. Now, put your will on the rock and say the word.
Geryon put his hands out in front of him and straightened his arms.
Push,
he commanded. He felt the surge and the roaring. With a resounding thud, the rock teetered and then rolled back smoothly to where it had been the morning before. Geryon suddenly felt bruised all over, and he sank to his knees in exhaustion.
Push! Belgarath said incredulously.
You said to say push.
I said to push. I didn't say to say push.
It went over. What difference does it make what word I used?
It's a question of style, the old man said with a pained look. Push sounds so babyish.
Weakly, Geryon began to laugh.
After all, Geryon, we do have a certain dignity to maintain, the old man said loftily. If we go around saying push or flop or things like that, no one's ever going to take us seriously.
Geryon wanted to stop laughing, but he simply couldn't. Belgarath stalked away indignantly, muttering to himself.
When they returned to the others, they found that the tents had been struck and the pack horses loaded.
"There's no point in staying here," Aunt Paul told them, "and the others are waiting for us. Did you manage to make him understand anything, Father?"
Belgorath grunted, his face set in an expression of profound disapproval.
"Things did not go well, I take it?"
"I'll explain later," he told her shortly.
During Geryon's absence, Tenedra, with much coaxing and a lapful of apples from their stores, had seduced the little colt into a kind of ecstatic subservience. He followed her about shamelessly, and the rather distant look he gave Geryon showed not the slightest trace of guilt.
"You're going to make him sick,"
Geryon accused her.
"Apples are good for horses,"
she replied airily.
"Tell her, Hattar."
"They won't hurt him," the hook-nosed man answered. "It is a customary way to gain the trust of a young horse."
Geryon tried to think of another suitable objection, but without success. For some reason, the sight of the little animal nuzzling at Tenedra offended him, though he could not exactly put his finger on why.
"Who are these others, Belgorath?" Silk asked as they rode. "The ones Palgara mentioned."
"My brothers," the old sorcerer replied. "Our masters advised them that we are coming."
"I've heard stories about the Brotherhood of Sorcerers all my life. Are they as remarkable as everyone says?" "I think you are in for a bit of a disappointment," Aunt Paul told him rather primly. "For the most part, sorcerers tend to be crotchety old men with a wide assortment of bad habits. I grew up amongst them, so I know them all rather well."
She turned her face to the thrush perched on her shoulder, singing adoringly.
"Yes," she said to the bird, "I know."
Geryon pulled closer to his aunt and began to listen very hard to the bird song. At first it was merely noise, pretty but without sense. Then, gradually, he began to pick up scraps of meaning, a bit here, a bit there. The bird was singing of nests and small speckled eggs and sunrises, and the overwhelming joy of flying. Then, as if his ears had suddenly opened, Geryon began to understand. Larks sang of flying and singing. Sparrows chirped of hidden little pockets of seeds. A hawk soaring overhead screamed its lonely song of riding the wind alone, and the fierce joy of the kill. Geryon was awed, as the air around him suddenly came alive with words. Aunt Paul looked at him gravely.
"It's a beginning," she said, without bothering to explain.
Geryon was so caught up in the world that had just opened to him that he did not see the two silvery-haired men at first. They stood together beneath a tall tree, waiting as the party rode nearer. They wore identical blue robes, and their white hair was quite long, though they were clean-shaven. When Geryon looked at them for the first time, he thought for a moment that his eyes were playing tricks. The two were so absolutely identical that it was impossible to tell them apart.
"Belgorath, our brother," one of them said. "It has been such a terribly long time,"
the other finished.
"Belgira,"
Belgorath said. "Belkira." He dismounted and embraced the twins.
"Dearest little Palgara,"
one of them said then.
"The veil has been,"
the other started.
"Empty without you,"
the second completed. He turned to his brother.
"That was very poetic,"
he said admiringly.
"Thank you,"
the first replied modestly.
"These are my brothers, Belgira and Belkira,"
Belgorath informed the members of the party who had begun to dismount.
"Don't bother to try to keep them separate. Nobody can tell them apart anyway."
"We can,"
the two said in unison.
"I am not even sure of that,"
Belgorath responded with a gentle smile.
"Your minds are so close together that your thoughts start with one and finish with the other."
"You have always complicated it so much, Father,"
Aunt Paul said.
"This is Belgira."
She kissed one of the sweet-faced old men.
And this is Belkira. She kissed the other. I have been able to tell them apart since I was a child.
Belgara knows all her secrets,
the twins smiled.
And who are your companions?
I think you'll recognize them, Belgarath answered. Mandoran, Baron of Omandor.
The Night Protector, the twins said in unison, bowing.
Prince Keldar of Dresnia.
Ah, the guide, they said.
Merak, Earl of Trelheim.
The Dreadful Bear.
They looked at the big Kerak apprehensively.
Barak's face darkened, but he said nothing. Hetar, son of Kohag of Algeria.
Ah, the Horse Lord.
And Durnik of Sundaria.
The one with two lives,
they murmured with profound respect. Durnik looked baffled at that.
Chenedra, Imperial Princess of Tunedra.
Our Queen of the World,
they replied, with another deep bow. Sinedra laughed nervously.
And this can only be Belgarian,
they said, their faces alive with joy.
The Chosen One.
The twins reached out in unison and laid their right hands on Garion's head. Their voices sounded within his mind.
Hail, Belgarian, overlord and champion, hope of the world.
Garion was too surprised at this strange benediction to do more than awkwardly nod his head.
If this gets any more cloying, I think I'll vomit,
a new voice, harsh and rasping, announced. The speaker, who had just stepped out from behind the tree, was a squat, misshapen old man, dirty and profoundly ugly. His legs were bowed and gnarled like oak trunks. His shoulders were huge, and his hands dangled below his knees. There was a large hump in the middle of his back, and his face was twisted into a grotesque caricature of a human countenance. His straggly iron-gray hair and beard were matted, and the twigs and bits of leaves were caught in the tangles. His hideous face wore an expression of perpetual contempt and anger.
Beldin, Belgareth said mildly, we weren't sure you would come.
Yes, I shouldn't have, you bungler,
the ugly man snapped.
You've made a mess of things as usual, Belgareth.
He turned toward the twins.
Get me something to eat,
he told them peremptorily.
Yes, Beldin,
they said quickly, and started away.
And don't be all day about it,
he shouted after them.
You seem to be in a good humor today, Beldin, Belgareth said, with no trace of sarcasm. What's made you so cheerful?
The ugly dwarf scowled at him, then laughed a short, barking sound.
I'm sorry, Belzedar. He looked like an unmade bed. Something had gone terribly wrong for him, and I enjoy that sort of thing.
Dear Uncle Beldin,
Aunt Paul said fondly, putting her arms around the filthy little man,
I have missed you so much.
Don't try to charm me, Palgara,
he told her, though his eyes seemed to soften slightly.
This is as much your fault as it is your father's. I thought you were going to keep an eye on him. How did Beldzedar get his hands on our master's orb?
We think he has used a child, Belgareth answered seriously. The orb will not strike an innocent.
The dwarf snorted.
There's no such thing as an innocent. All men are born corrupt.
He turned his eyes back to Aunt Paul and looked appraisingly at her.
You're getting fat, he said bluntly. Your hips are as wide as an ox cart.
Durnik immediately clenched his fists and went for the hideous little man. The dwarf laughed, and one of his big hands caught the front of the smith's tunic. Without any seeming effort, he lifted the surprised Durnik and threw him several yards away.
You can start your second life right now, if you want,
he growled threateningly.
Let me handle this, Durnik,
Aunt Paul told the smith.
Beldin,
she said coolly,
How long has it been since you've had a bath?
The dwarf shrugged.
Rained on me a couple of months ago.
Not hard enough, though. You smell like an uncleaned pigsty.
Belden grinned at her.
That's my girl. I was afraid the years had taken off your edge, he chortled.
The two of them then began to trade the most hair-raising insults that Geryon had ever heard in his life. Graphic, ugly words passed back and forth between them, almost sizzling in the air. Barak's eyes widened in astonishment, and Mandorolan's face blanched often. Zenedra, her face flaming, bolted out of earshot. The worse the insults, however, the more the hideous Belden smiled. Finally, Aunt Paul delivered an epithet so vile that Geryon actually cringed, and the ugly little man collapsed on the ground, roaring with laughter and hammering at the dirt with his great fists.
By the gods, I have missed you, Paul, he gasped. Come here, give us a kiss.
She smiled, kissing his dirty face affectionately.
Mangy dog.
You big cow,
he grinned, catching her in a crushing embrace.
I'll need my ribs more or less in one piece, Uncle, she told him.
I haven't cracked any of your ribs in years, my girl.
Yes, and I'd like to keep it that way.
The twins hurried across to the dwarf Belden, carrying a large plate of steaming stew and a huge tankard. The ugly man looked curiously at the plate, then casually dumped the stew on the ground and tossed the plate away.
Doesn't smell too bad.
He squatted and began to stuff the food into his mouth with both hands, pausing only now and then to spit out some of the larger pebbles that clung to the chunks of meat. When he had finished, he swilled down the contents of the tankard, belched thunderously, and sat back, scratching at his matted hair with his gravy-smeared fingers.
Now, let's get down to business.
Where have you been? Belgareth asked him.
Central Tol Murgos. I've been sitting on a hilltop since the Battle of Omimre, watching the cave where Belzidar took Torak.
500 years? Silk gasped. Belden shrugged.
Yes, more or less,
he replied indifferently.
Somebody had to keep an eye on Burnt Face, and I wasn't doing anything that couldn't be interrupted.
You said you saw Belzidar?
About a month ago. Came to the cave. As if he had a demon on his tail. Pulled Torak out. Then he changed himself into a vulture and flew off with the body.
It must have been right after Tuchuk caught him at the Nissen border and took the orb away from him.
Well, I wouldn't know about that. That was part of your responsibility, not mine. All I was supposed to do was keep watch over Torak. Did any of the ashes fall on you?
Which ashes? One of the twins asked.
When Belzidar took Torak out of the cave, the mountain exploded, blew its guts out. I imagine it had something to do with the force surrounding old One-Eye's body. It was still blowing when I left.
We wondered what had caused that eruption. It put ash down an inch deep all over Nyssa.
Good. Too bad it wasn't deeper.
Did you see any signs of Torak stirring? The twins asked.
Can't you two ever talk straight?
Belden demanded.
We're sorry.
It's our nature.
The ugly little man shook his head with disgust.
Well, never mind. No, Torak didn't move once in the whole 500 years. There was mold on him when Belzidar dragged him out of that cave.
Did you follow Belzidar?
Well, naturally.
Where did he take Torak?
Now, where do you think, idiot? To the ruins of Tol Marthrak and Meloria, of course. There are only a few places on Earth that will bear Torak's weight. That's one of them. Belzidar has to keep Tochuk and the orb away from Torak. That's the only place he could go. The Malorian Grolems refuse to accept Tuchuk's authority. So Belzidar will be safe there. It will cost him a great deal to pay for their aid. But they'll keep Tuchuk out of Meloria, unless he raises an army of Murgos and invades.
There's something we could hope for, Barak said.
You're supposed to be a bear, not a donkey, Belden told him. Don't base your hopes on the impossible. Neither Tochik nor Beljadar would start that sort of a war at this particular time. Not with Belgarian here stalking through the world like an earthquake.
He scowled at Aunt Paul then.
Can't you teach him to be a little quieter? Or are your wits getting as flabby as your behind?
Be civil, uncle, she replied. The boy is just coming into his strength. We were all a bit clumsy at first.
He doesn't have time to be a baby, Paul. The stars are dropping into southern Khrol Murgos like poisoned roaches. Dead Grolems are moaning in their tombs from Rakthol to Rakhaga. Time is on us. He's got to be ready.
He will be ready, uncle.
Maybe,
the filthy old man said sourly. Are you going back to Tol Mishrak? Belgarath asked.
No. Our master told me to stay here. The twins and I have work to do, and we don't have much time.
He spoke to us, too.
Stop that,
Belden snapped at the twins. He turned back to Belgarath.
Are you going to Rakhtol now?
Not yet. We've got to go to Prolgu first. I have to talk to the Gurum. And we've got to pick up another member of the party.
Yes, I noticed that your group was not yet complete. What about the last one?
Belgarath spread his hands. That's the one that worries me. I have not been able to find any trace of her. And I have been looking for 3,000 years.
You've spent too much time looking in alehouses.
I noticed the same thing, uncle, Aunt Paul said with a sweet little smile.
Where do we go after Prolgu? Barak wanted to know. I think that then we will go to Rakhtol, Belgarath replied rather grimly. We have got to get that orb back from Tuchik. And I have been meaning to have a rather pointed discussion with that magician of the Murgos for a long time now.
Part 3. Ulgo. Chapter 13. The following morning, they turned northwest and rode toward the stark white peaks of the mountains of Ulgo, glittering in the morning sun above the lush meadows of the vale.
There's snow up there, Barak observed. It could be a difficult trip.
It always is, Hethar told him.
Have you been to Prolgu before?
Dornick asked. A few times. We keep communications open with the Ulgos. Our visits there are mostly ceremonial.
Princess Zenedra had been riding beside Aunt Paul, her tiny face troubled.
How can you stand him, Lady Polgara?
She burst out finally.
He's so ugly.
And who is that, dear?
That awful dwarf.
Uncle Belden? Aunt Paul looked mildly surprised. Why, he's always been like that. You have to get to know him, that's all.
But he says such terrible things to you.
It is the way that he hides his real feelings, Aunt Paul explained. He's a very gentle person, really, but people don't expect that coming from him. When he was a child, his people drove him out because he was so deformed and hideous. When he finally came to the Vale, our master saw past that ugliness to the beauty in his mind.
But does he have to be so dirty?
Aunt Paul shrugged slightly.
He hates his deformed body, so he ignores it.
She looked at the princess, her eyes calm. It is the easiest thing in the world to judge things by appearance, Zenedra, and it is usually wrong. Uncle Belden and I are very fond of each other. That's why we take the trouble to invent such elaborate insults. Compliments would be hypocrisy. He is, after all, very ugly.
I just don't understand,
Zenedra sounded baffled.
Love can show itself in many strange ways, Aunt Paul told her. Her tone was offhand, but the look she directed at the tiny princess was penetrating. Zenedra flickered one quick look at Geryon,
and then averted her eyes, blushing slightly. Geryon considered the exchange between his Aunt Paul and the princess as he rode. It was quite obvious that Aunt Paul had been telling the little girl something important, but whatever it was escaped him. They rode for several days across the vale, and then moved up into the foothills, which clustered along the flanks of the ragged peaks that formed the land of the Ulgos. Once again the seasons changed as they rode. It was very early autumn as they crested the first low range, and the valleys beyond were aflame with crimson leaves. At the top of a second, higher range, the trees had been swept bare, and the wind had the first bite of winter in it as it whistled down from the peaks. The sky grew overcast, and tendrils of cloud seeped down the rocky gorges above them. Spits of intermittent snow and rain pelted at them as they climbed higher up the rocky slopes.
"I suppose we had better start keeping an eye out for Brill," Silk said hopefully, one snowy afternoon. "It's about time for him to show up again."
"Not very likely," Belgareth replied. "Murgos avoid Ulgoland even more than they avoid the Vale. Ulgos dislike Angrax intensely."
"So do Aelons."
"Ulgos can see in the dark, though," the old man told him. "Murgos who come into these mountains tend not to wake up from their first night's sleep up here. I don't think we need to worry about Brill."
"Pity,"
Silk murmured with a certain disappointment.
"It won't hurt to keep our eyes open, though. There are worse things than Murgos in the mountains of Ulgo."
Silk scoffed. "Aren't those stories exaggerated?"
"No, not really." "The region abounds with monsters, Prince Keldar," Mandorallan assured the little man. "Some years back, a dozen foolish young knights of my acquaintance rode into these mountains to test their bravery and prowess against these unseemly beasts. Not one of them returned."
When they crested the next ridge, the full force of a winter gale struck at them. Snow, which had grown steadily heavier as they climbed, drove horizontally in the howling wind.
"We'll have to take cover until this blows over, Belgareth," Beric shouted above the wind, fighting to keep his flapping bearskin cape around him. "Let's drop down into the next valley," Belgareth replied, also struggling with his cloak. "The trees down there should break this wind."
They crossed the ridge and angled down toward the pines clustered at the bottom of the basin ahead. Geryon pulled his cloak tighter, bowing his head into the shrieking wind. The thick stand of sapling pine in the basin blocked the force of the gale, but the snow swirled about them as they reined in.
"We're not going to get much farther today, Belgareth," Beric declared, trying to brush the snow out of his beard. "We might as well haul up here and wait for the morning." "What's that?"
Durnik asked sharply, cocking his head to one side.
"The wind?"
Beric shrugged.
"No. Listen."
Above the howling of the wind, a shrill whinnying sound came to them.
"Look there," Hetar pointed.
Dimly they saw a dozen horse-like animals crossing the ridge behind them. Their shapes were blurred by the thickly falling snow, and their line, as they moved, seemed almost ghostly. On a rise just above them stood a huge stallion, his mane and tail tossing in the wind. His neigh was almost a shrill scream.
"Hrulgen," Belgareth said sharply.
"Can we outrun them?" Silk asked hopefully.
"I doubt it," Belgareth replied. "Besides, they have got our scent now. They'll dog our trail from here to Prolgu if we try to run. Then we must teach them to fear our trail and to avoid it,"
Mandorallan declared, tightening the straps on his shield. His eyes were very bright.
"You're falling back into your old habits, Mandorallan," Beric observed in a grumpy voice.
Hetar's face had assumed that curiously blank expression it usually did when he was communicating with his horses. He shuddered finally, and his eyes went sick with revulsion.
"Well?"
Aunt Paul asked him.
They are not horses, he began.
We know that, Hittar. Can you do anything with them? Frighten them off, perhaps?
He shook his head.
They are hungry, Pogora. And they have our scent. The herd stallion seems to have much more control over them than he would if they were horses. I might be able to frighten one or two of the weaker ones if it were not for him.
Then we'll have to fight them all,
Barak said grimly, buckling on his shield.
I do not think so,
Hittar replied, his eyes narrowing.
The key seems to be the stallion. He dominates the whole herd. I think that if we kill him, the rest will turn and run.
All right, Barak said. We try for the stallion, then.
We might want to make some kind of noise,
Hittar suggested.
Something that sounds like a challenge. That might make him come out to the front to answer it. Otherwise, we will have to go through the whole herd to get to him.
Mayhap this will provoke him,
Mandaraman said. He lifted his horn to his lips and blew a brassy note of ringing defiance that was whipped away by the gale. The stallion's shrill scream answered immediately.
It sounds like it's working, Barak observed. Blow it again, Mandaraman.
Mandaraman sounded his horn again, and again the stallion shrilled in reply. Then the great beast plunged down from the ridgetop and charged furiously through the herd toward them. When he reached the forefront, he shrieked again and reared up on his hind legs, his front claws flashing in the snowy air.
That did it, Barak barked. Let's go.
He jammed his spurs home, and his big gray leaped forward, spraying snow behind him. Hittar and Mandaraman swept out to flank him, and the three plunged forward through the thickly falling snow toward the screaming Hrulga stallion. Mandaraman set his lance as he charged, and a strange sound drifted back on the wind as he thundered toward the advancing Hrulgan. Mandaraman was laughing. Geryon drew his sword and pulled his horse in front of Aunt Paul and Zenedra. He realized that it was probably a futile gesture, but he did it anyway. Two of the Hrulgan, perhaps at the herd stallion's unspoken command, bounded forward to cut off Barak and Mandaraman, while the stallion himself moved to meet Hittar, as if recognizing the Algar as the greatest potential danger to the herd. As the first Hrulga reared, his fangs bared in a cat-like snarl and his clawed feet widespread, Mandaraman lowered his lance and drove it through the snarling monster's chest. Bloody froth burst from the Hrulga's mouth, and he toppled over backward, clawing the broken shaft of Mandaraman's lance into splinters as he fell. Barak caught a clawed swipe on his shield and split open the head of the second Hrulga with a vast overhand swing of his heavy sword. The beast collapsed, his convulsions churning the snow. Hittar and the herd stallion stalked each other in the swirling snow. They moved warily, circling. Their eyes locked on each other with a deadly intensity. Suddenly, the stallion reared and lunged all in one motion, his great forelegs wide and his claws outspread. But Hittar's horse, his mind linked with his rider's, danced clear of the furious charge. The Hrulga spun and charged again, and once again Hittar's horse jumped to the side. The infuriated stallion screamed his frustration and lunged in, his claws flailing. Hittar's horse sidestepped this enraged beast, then darted in, and Hittar launched himself from his saddle and landed on the stallion's back. His long, powerful legs locked about the Hrulga's ribs, and his right hand gathered a great fistful of the animal's mane. The stallion went mad as he felt for the first time in the entire history of his species the weight of a rider on his back. He plunged and reared and shrieked, trying to shake Hittar off. The rest of the herd, which had been moving to the attack, faltered and stared in uncomprehending horror at the stallion's wild attempts to dislodge his rider. Mandaraman and Barak reined in, dumbfounded, as Hittar rode the raging stallion in circles through the blizzard. Then, grimly, Hittar slid his left hand down his leg and drew a long, broad dagger from his boot. He knew horses, and he knew where to strike. His first thrust was lethal. The churned snow turned red. The stallion reared one last time, screaming and with blood pouring out of his mouth. And then he dropped, back to stand on shuddering legs. Slowly his knees buckled and he toppled to one side. Hedhar jumped clear. The herd of the Hrolgan turned and fled, squealing, back into the blizzard. Hedhar grimly cleaned his dagger in the snow and resheathed it in his boot. Briefly he had laid one hand on the dead stallion's neck, then turned to look through the trampled snow for the saber he had discarded in his wild leap onto the stallion's back. When the three warriors returned to the shelter of the trees, Mandaralan and Barak were staring at Hedhar with a look of profound respect.
"It is a shame that they are mad," the Algar said, with a distant look on his face. "There was a moment, just a moment, when I almost got through to him, and we moved together. Then the madness came back, and I had to kill him. If they could be tamed..."
He broke off and shook his head.
"Oh, well," he shrugged regretfully.
"You wouldn't actually ride something like that."
Durnik's voice was shocked.
"I have never had an animal like that under me,"
Hedhar said quietly.
"I do not think that I will ever forget what it is like."
The tall man turned and walked some distance away, and he stood staring out into the swirling snow. They set up for the night in the shelter of the pines. The next morning the wind had abated, although it was still snowing heavily, when they set out again. The snow was already knee-deep, and the horses struggled as they climbed. They crossed yet another ridge and started down into the next valley. Silk looked dubiously around at the thickly falling snow settling through the silent air.
"If it gets much deeper, we're going to bog down, Belgarath," he said glumly. "Particularly if we have to keep climbing like this."
"We will be all right now," the old man assured him. "We follow a series of valleys from here. They lead right up to Progo, so we can avoid the peaks."
"Belgarath," Beric said back over his shoulder from his place in the lead, "there are some fresh tracks up here."
He pointed ahead at a line of footprints plowed through the new snow across their path. The old man moved ahead and stopped to examine the tracks.
"Algroth," he said shortly, "we had better keep our eyes open."
They rode warily down into the valley where Mandaralan paused long enough to cut himself a fresh lance.
"I'd be a little dubious about a weapon that keeps breaking," Barak observed as the knight remounted.
Mandaralan shrugged, his armor creaking.
"There are always trees around, my lord," he replied.
Back among the pines that carpeted the valley floor, Geryon heard a familiar barking.
"Grandfather,"
he warned.
"I hear them," Belgarath answered.
"How many, do you think?"
Silk asked.
Perhaps a dozen."
"8, Aunt Paul corrected firmly.
"If they are but 8, will they dare attack?" Mandaralan asked. "Those we met in Arendia seem to seek courage in numbers." "Their lair is in this valley, I think," the old man replied. "Any animal tries to defend its lair, they are almost certain to attack."
"We must seek them out, then," the knight declared confidently. "Better to destroy them now on ground of our own choosing, than to be surprised in some ambush."
"He is definitely backsliding," Barak observed sourly to Hedhar.
"And he is probably right this time," Hedhar replied.
"Have you been drinking, Hedhar?"
Barak asked suspiciously.
"Come, my lords," Mandaralan said gaily. "Let us rout these brutes so that we may continue our journey unmolested."
He plowed off through the snow in search of the barking Algroths.
"You coming, Barak?"
Hedhar invited as he drew his saber.
Barak sighed.
"I guess I'd better,"
he answered mournfully. He turned to Belgarath.
"This shouldn't take long. I will try to keep our bloodthirsty friends out of trouble."
Hedhar laughed.
You're getting to be as bad as he is, Beric accused, as the two of them moved into a gallop alongside of Mandarallan.
Garion and the others sat waiting tensely in the sifting snowfall. Then the barking sounds off in the woods suddenly turned into yelps of surprise. The sound of blows began to ring through the trees, and there were shrieks of pain and shouts as the three warriors called to each other. After perhaps a quarter of an hour, they came galloping back with the deep snow spraying out from their horses' hooves.
Two of them got away,
Hetar reported regretfully.
What a shame, Silk replied.
Mandarallan, Breck said with a pained look, you have picked up a bad habit somewhere. Fighting is a serious business, and all of this giggling and laughing of yours is smacks of frivolity.
Doth it offend thee, my lord?
It's not so much that it offends me, Mandarallan. It is more a distraction. It breaks my concentration.
I shall strive to moderate my laughter in the future, then.
Well, I would appreciate it.
How did it go? Silk asked.
It wasn't much of a fight. We caught them completely by surprise. I hate to admit it, but our tortling friend there was right for once.
Garion thought about Mandarallan's changed behavior as they rode on down into the valley. Back at the cave, where the colt had been born, Durnak had told Mandarallan that fear could be conquered by laughing at it, and though Durnak had probably not meant it in precisely that way, Mandarallan had taken his words quite literally. The laughter which so irritated Barak was not directed at the foe that he met, but rather at the enemy within. Mandarallan was laughing at his own fear as he rode to each attack.
It's unnatural, Barak was muttering to Silk. That's what bothers me so much. Not only that, it's a breach of etiquette. If we ever get into a serious fight, it's going to be terribly embarrassing to have him giggling and carrying on like that. What will the people think?
You're making too much of it, Beric, Silk told him. Actually, I think it's rather refreshing.
You think it's what?
Refreshing. An errand with a sense of humor is a novelty, after all. Sort of like a talking dog.
Barak shook his head with disgust.
There's absolutely no point in ever trying to discuss anything seriously with you. Did you know that, Silk? This compulsion of yours to make clever remarks turns everything into a joke.
Oh, we all have our little shortcomings, Silk admitted blandly.
Chapter 14. The snow gradually slackened throughout the rest of the day, and by evening, only a few solitary flakes drifted down through the darkening air as they set up for the night in a grove of dense spruces. During the night, however, the temperature fell, and the air was bitterly cold when they arose the next morning.
How much farther to Progu?
Silk asked, standing close to the fire with his shivering hands stretched out to its warmth.
2 more days,
Belgarath replied.
I don't suppose that you would consider doing something about the weather, the little man asked hopefully.
I prefer not to do that, unless I absolutely have to, the old man told him. It disrupts things over a very wide area. Besides, the Gorim doesn't like us to tamper with things in his mountains. The Ulgos have reservations about that sort of thing.
I was afraid that you might look at it that way.
Their route that morning twisted and turned so often that by noon Garion was completely turned around. Despite the biting cold, the sky was overcast, a solid lead gray. It seemed somehow as if the cold had frozen all color from the world. The sky was gray, the snow was a flat, dead white, and the tree trunks were starkly black. Even the rushing water in the streams they followed flowed black between snow-mounded banks. Belgarath moved confidently, pointing their direction as each succeeding valley intersected with another.
Are you sure?
The shivering Silk asked him at one point.
We've been going upstream all day, and now you say we go down.
We'll hit another valley in a few miles. Trust me, Silk. I have been here before.
Silk pulled his heavy cloak tighter. It's just that I get nervous on unfamiliar ground, he objected, looking at the dark water of the river that they were following. From far upstream came a strange sound, a kind of mindless hooting that was almost like laughter. Aunt Paul and Belgareth exchanged a quick look.
What is it?
Geryon asked.
Rock wolf,
Belgareth answered shortly.
It doesn't sound like a wolf.
It isn't.
The old man looked around warily.
They're scavengers for the most part, and if it's just a wild pack, they probably won't attack. It is too early in the winter for them to be that desperate. If it is one of the packs that has been raised by the Eldraken, though, well, then we are in for trouble.
He stood up in his stirrups to look ahead.
Let's pick up the pace a bit, he called to Mandaraman. Keep your eyes open.
Mandaraman, his armor glittering with frost, glanced back, nodded, and moved out at a trot, following the seething black water of the mountain river. Behind them, the shrill, yelping laughter grew louder.
They're following us, Father,
Aunt Paul said.
I can hear that.
The old man began searching the sides of the valley with his eyes. His face creased with a worried frown.
You'd better have a look, Paul. I do not want any surprises.
Aunt Paul's eyes grew distant as she probed the thickly forested sides of the valley with her mind. After a moment, she gasped and then shuddered.
There's an Eldrak out there, Father. He's watching us. His mind is a sewer.
Yeah, they always are,
the old man replied.
Could you pick up his name?
Groll.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. I knew we were getting close to his range.
He put his fingers to his lips and whistled sharply. Barak and Mandaraman halted to wait while the rest caught up with them.
We've got trouble, Belgareth told them all seriously. There's an Eldrak out there with a pack of rock wolves. He is watching us right now. It's only a question of time until he attacks.
What is an Eldrak? Silk asked.
The Eldrakin are related to Algroths and trolls, but they are more intelligent and much bigger. But only one?
Mandaraman asked.
One is enough. I have met this one. His name is Groll. He's big, quick, and as cruel as a hook-pointed knife. He will eat anything that moves, and he does not really care if it is dead or not before he starts to eat it.
The hooting laughter of the rock wolves drew closer.
Let's find an open place and build a fire, the old man said. The rock wolves are afraid of fire, and there is no point in fighting them and Groll if we don't have to. There,
Durnik suggested, pointing to a broad, snow-covered bar protruding out into the dark water of the river. The bar was joined to the near bank by a narrow neck of gravel and sand.
It's defensible, Valarath.
Barak approved, squinting at the bar.
The river will keep them off of our backs, and they can only come at us across that one narrow place. It will do, Belgareth agreed shortly. Let's go.
They rode out onto the snow-covered bar, and quickly scraped an area clear with their feet, while Durnik worked to build a fire under a large gray driftwood snag that half-blocked the narrow neck of the bar. Within a few moments, orange flames began to lick up around the snag. Durnik fed the fire with sticks until the snag was fully ablaze.
Give me a hand,
the smith said, starting to pile larger pieces of wood onto the fire. Barak and Mandaraman went to the jumbled mass of driftwood piled against the upstream edge of the gravel and began hauling limbs and chunks of log to the fire. At the end of a quarter of an hour, they had built a roaring bonfire that stretched across the narrow neck of sand, cutting them off completely from the dark trees on the riverbank.
That is the first time that I have been warm all day,
Silk grinned, backing up to the fire.
They're coming,
Geryon warned. Back among the dark tree trunks, he had caught a few glimpses of furtive movement.
Barak peered through the flames. Big brutes, aren't they?
He observed grimly.
About the size of a donkey,
Belgarath confirmed. Are you sure that they are afraid of fire? Silk asked nervously.
Most of the time.
Most of the time?
Once in a while they get desperate. Or Grull could drive them toward us. They would be more afraid of him than of the fire.
Belgarath, the weasel-faced little man objected. Sometimes you have got a nasty habit of keeping things to yourself. One of the rock wolves came out onto the riverbank just upstream from the bar and stood sniffing at the air, looking nervously toward the fire. Its forelegs were noticeably longer than its hind ones, giving it a peculiar half-erect stance, and there was a large, muscular hump across its shoulders. Its muzzle was short, and it seemed snub-faced, almost like a cat. Its coat was splotchy, black and white, marked with a pattern hovering somewhere between spots and stripes. It paced nervously back and forth, staring at them with a dreadful intensity, and yelping its high-pitched, hooting laugh. Soon, another came out to join it, and then another. They spread out along the bank, pacing and hooting, but staying well back from the fire.
They don't look like dogs, exactly, Dernick said. They're not, Belgarath replied. Wolves and dogs are related, but rock wolves belong in a different family.
By now, 10 of the ugly creatures lined the bank, and their hooting rose in a mindless chorus. Then Tenedra screamed, her face deathly pale and her eyes wide with horror. The Eldrak shambled out of the trees and stood in the middle of the yelping pack. It was about 8 feet tall, covered with shaggy black fur. It wore an armored shirt that had been made of large scraps of chain mail tied together with thongs. Over the mail, also held in place with leather thongs, was a rusty breastplate that appeared to have been hammered out with rocks until it was big enough to fit around the creature's massive chest. A conical steel helmet, split up the back to make it fit, covered the brute's head. In its hand, the Eldrak held a huge, steel-wrapped club, studded with spikes. It was the face, however, that had brought the scream to Tenedra's lips. The Eldrak had virtually no nose, and its lower jaw jutted, showing two massive, protruding tusks. Its eyes were sunk in deep sockets beneath a heavy ridge of bone across its brow, and they burned with a hideous hunger.
"That's far enough, Grull," Belgarath warned the thing in a cold, deadly voice.
"Grat, come back to Grull's mountain,"
the monster growled. Its voice was deep, hollow, and chilling.
"It talks," Silk gasped incredulously.
"Why are you following us, Grull?"
Belgarath demanded. The creature stared at them, its eyes like fire.
"Hungry, Grat," it growled.
"Go hunt something else," the old man told the monster.
"Why? Horses, here. Men, plenty to eat.
But not easy food, Grull."
A hideous grin spread across Grull's face.
"Fight first, then eat. Come, Grat. Fight again."
"Grat?" Silk asked. "He means me. He cannot pronounce my name. It has to do with the shape of his jaw."
"You fought that thing?"
Barak sounded stunned.
Belgarath shrugged. "I had a knife up my sleeve. When he grabbed me, I sliced him open. It wasn't much of a fight.